This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 26th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 303 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the programme today, we'll be meeting author and journalist Caitlin Davies to learn why a dip in London's River Thames isn't quite the public health disaster you might expect. In fact, it floats many people's boats.
And we'll hear about the skate girls of Kabul with photographer Jessica Fulford-Dobson, whose images of skateboarding the Afghan capital are currently on show at London's Saatchi Gallery.
Plus, we'll meet Steve Boggan, the writer who's taken a shine to gold and went all the way to the USA to find some of it.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's resident 1950s dreamboat, Danny Jacopelli, will be here with the news look ahead. We might play a song or two as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom. Hello, everybody out there. What a strange menu we had today's programme. I'm looking forward to meeting 1950s Dream Ball.
Yeah.
Or is he a dream boat?
Dream boat, I think he is. But okay. Then it said Daniel Jacopelli. That doesn't make sense.
Do you remember the popular game show, sort of spoof game show Shooting Stars?
Of course
on
I
BBC
do.
TV,
one of my favourites.
Starring Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer. Mm. We really want to show our fingers. Mark Lamar, once a great fixture on our television screens and radio. He's a great radio broadcaster in my estimation. No longer on the radio. I don't know where he's gone. Maybe we should hire him for Monocle 24. That's in brackets.
He'd be welcome.
He was considered a 1950s throwback, wasn't he? He
was
a cheeky con man and all that.
His constant moniker.
Yeah, it's 1950s greaseball, Mark Lamar. Because he favoured the slick back hair, he had a big Elvis quiff. He looked a bit like Richard Hawley.
Oh, Richard Hawley, yeah. No, he did.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to everything today, but before we do it, we should talk about the Monocle conference. Maybe.
It was. That was a lot of fun. We were in Lisbon. The conference, I thought, went pretty well. What are your main takeaways from that, Rob?
What I love about it was working on the weekend.
Can I just say, my favourite panellist was Eric Speakerman. He had a lot of positive things to say to you, didn't he? Particularly at the start of the day on the Saturday.
Yeah, he did. He really started things off with a bit of a Speakerman bang. We all enjoyed a big night out on Friday night in Lisbon. We had a drinks party and we had a dinner, which was great. Ended quite late or early on the Saturday morning. We all had to sort of be at the venue at 7:30 in the morning. Well, some of us a little bit tired and emotional, a little bit ruddy of face, sweaty of brow.
I was fresh-faced.
You were fresh-faced. I thought I'd gotten away with it until Eric Speakerman came up to me after I'd been on stage for an hour talking about media and said, "If you feel as shit as you look, I should go to the hair and makeup." And so I did.
Classic.
Classic Speakerman, so that was good. That really made me feel that my first hour on stage had been a profitable one.
It was very good, though, and I thought there were lots of interesting sessions. The substance of the event, I thought, was it was meaty, wasn't it?
It was meaty. One of my other favourite takeaways from it was Andrew Keen, the media I suppose he's a polemicist, actually. Mm. Works in Silicon Valley for years, and he's now written this great book, Why the Internet is Not the Answer. Talked in, we should let our listeners know, an analogous and metaphorical way about Tyler's balls. Quite a lot, didn't he?
Yes, that's right.
He was like, "What I admire about you is your balls." And luckily, Ty was standing behind a large oak desk at the time, so people could not necessarily have to judge for themselves. They were my two takeaways from the Monocle Quality of Life Conference.
Very
2015
good.
In Lisbon.
And what a lovely warm welcome the city as well.
Yeah,
the
I love
the city collective gave
on
to
a
everybody.
Serious note, it was really cool. And the city is beautiful. The food is great. The wine is absolutely amazing. One of those great things, all the Portuguese seem to keep their best wine in Portugal, so you have to go there. Ladies and gentlemen, to experience.
And we're all happy to drink to that.
Yeah, exactly. Nice, we've got a great show lined up. Shall we dive right into it? With the aforementioned Danny Jacopelli and his news look ahead.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny.
I love that.
I love that too.
Do you love it, Daniel? That's your special welcome music?
Danny, it's not Daniel, it's Danny.
Okay, Danny. Do you like your welcome music?
I do love it. I'm a dreamboat, what could I say?
He's a dreamboat.
I don't think you can say that.
I don't know. You can, yeah.
So they say.
It's a bit like saying that you yourself don't suffer fools gladly. It's something only other people can say about you.
Yeah. Fine. Okay.
What's happening around the world this week, Daniel? What do we need to know about?
well, I sound very kind of depressed and I sighed there, but it's a mix of serious and fun. Let's put it this way. It starts with Shinzo Abe in the U.S. and it ends with World Naked Gardening Day.
So can we guess which one's fun and which one's sad?
You can guess. Shinzo Abe, he's indeed in the U.S. as of today, Sunday. He's going to meet Obama. Also at the same time today, Kazakhstan is holding snap presidential elections. So I got the serious out of the way. Now we can get a bit zany. Well, not too zany. So the London Marathon is today also.
There's a lot of costumes, aren't there, at the London Marathon? A lot of people do it for charity. They dress up as rhinos.
That's true. Did either of you guys do the jog in Lisbon? We had a jog at the conference.
It was a little bit too bright.
I did a very fast walk from my hotel to the conference hotel. I was running rather late.
It turns out there was quite a few people that went there. I think there was 40 or 50 people that did that.
The run?
The run.
Really?
Yep.
I know that our very own Richard Spencer Powell went on it.
Yeah, he did.
7 a.m.
Led the way, he tells me.
I heard that Hans Neuenhaus, who's the editor of NRC newspaper in Amsterdam, was a leisurely jog and a tour of Lisbon by a sort of city guide. And then when he realised he had to be on stage in 20 minutes or sort of something, he suddenly just accelerated and did the whole thing in the next 5 minutes, then went back to his hotel and had a shower.
You ran pretty fast the other day, Tom. You almost forgot to do the news live and you bolted downstairs.
That's true.
That's the fastest I've ever seen anybody run.
The old magic's still there.
Yeah.
My knees.
You still have to invent the news. What happened?
Yeah, I just, you know.
And news just in, I'm really sweaty. And I wish I'd done this in my sneakers.
You tuned in. Yeah. It was a little bit like that. Yeah, you got to keep yourself in shape, Daniel. That's the secret.
Well, I'm not in middle age yet, so we'll see. National Pretzel Day is also today. And I find this very fascinating. Do you know anything about pretzels?
They nearly killed George W. Bush.
That is true. Oh, that's a
good
fact.
One. Yeah.
It's the world's oldest snack, so says probably the Pretzel Lobby Association. It traced back to 610 AD in a monastery in southern France or Italy. An imaginative monk wanted to use the dough left over from baking bread. So he made strips and formed them to represent children's arms folded in prayer. That's the pretzel.
Is that true? Have you made that up?
I did not make
that
up.
That would be really good if you made it up. Come on.
Kudos if that's the case.
That's quite chapeau, good. They said in 610 AD in Avignon.
And in fact, the word pretzel comes from pretiola, the Latin word for little reward. Learn something new every day.
That's really good.
That's good. I like that.
I really like that. Thanks. I love a pretzel.
I like to learn a food-related nugget on a Sunday.
Pretzel bread is really delicious. I can't find anywhere in London that does it very well. I miss it from going back and forth to Berlin a lot last year. It's really good.
Yeah.
Love it.
What about in those sort of beer Haller type places?
Can I get that in London? Beer Haller?
Yeah, a few places.
Okay.
We've been nominated for a Webby Award.
Oh, yeah.
And the winners are chosen this week. Monday.
We should pick this up for our readers.
It's too late for people to vote, though, when you're listening right now.
But, okay. Yeah, but they've already.
In what category? Have they got different categories? What is it?
Yeah, so we're in the radio podcast audio category.
Yep.
And we can win the judges' award.
Okay.
Next Saturday, it's the Kentucky Derby.
Where does that take place, Danny? Is it in Kentucky?
It is indeed in Kentucky. Lots of bourbon, mint juleps. Have you ever been to mint juleps?
Oh, yeah, I like a mint julep.
Rob pipes in then when he hears a mint julep. I've never been, but I've always wanted to do the whiskey trail, which is you hop from little kind of town to town tasting whiskey.
And then you pitch up on a Derby.
Well, you could do it during the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, it's a coincidental.
A lot of people kind of fly and they do the whiskey trail thing, and then they go to the Derby.
Can bourbon only be from Kentucky?
Technically, bourbon has to be from Bourbon County.
Uh huh.
So yes, it has to be from Bourbon County. But I mean, other people call their stuff bourbon. It's a bit complicated.
It's erroneous.
American whiskey. Some people get away with it. Calling it bourbon.
I like to do both of those things. I like a flutter. I like the GGs.
Okay.
The big horse racing events are amazing. Trail. You should definitely.
I've been to the Belmont
things.
Stakes.
That's pretty good.
Over in my area of the woods.
But I like it when there's like a Triple Crown contender in action.
Why do you like
Danny just didn't say the word neck there. He's got a weak, like it's his kryptonite. He can't say the word neck. In my area of the woods.
Neck of the woods.
What's between your head and your shoulders? Just nothing.
Speaking of anatomy, Rob, it's World Naked Gardening Day on the 2nd, which is also on Saturday.
What sort of body would set up something called World Naked Gardening Day? Whose interest is this
well,
in?
Well, now that you ask, it's the Body Freedom Collaborative.
Okay.
That doesn't really sound like an organization, but it's this is how they describe it. People across the globe are encouraged to tend their portion of the world's garden, clothed as nature intended. You can do it on a hiking trail, in a city park, or on the streets.
Okay, I like
there
that.
We are. Also, I'm not done. One more final one.
I just got to say about this. You know, gardening, you got a lot of
it's
things.
It's a
very
British thing.
You might have thistles. They got little spikes on them. You've got all sorts of nettles.
Roses.
The nettle, yeah.
Roses with thorns. Is that not just a threat to genitals everywhere?
Yeah, that's where we leave that
yeah,
one.
Well, okay.
We should have left a really good silence after
and
that.
And next Sunday, it's Hedgehog Awareness Week.
Oh, my God.
Where are you finding these things?
I have my sources.
Okay, Hedgehog Awareness Week. Well, you know, they're always getting run over, and now they make little tunnels under the roads, don't they? Like, they're different toads and they're different...
See, you'd have to watch out for hedgehogs on naked gardening. You wouldn't want to tread on a hedgehog, would you, if you weren't wearing any shoes?
You wouldn't want to get stung by a bee.
And I think I talked about Hedgehog Awareness Week last year, too, at the same time. So I'm consistent across
some of these
years.
Things crop up
I've
every
seen some
year.
Brown envelopes arriving on Danny's desk with just a sort of like
spikes on it.
With yeah, like a spiked logo on it. I think that's we know exactly where that new Porsche has come from. Let's play out with Danny's theme tune. He's a 1950s throwback.
Danny, there's no other but Danny.
Having been consumed by a brutal tug of war between Western military powers, Islamist insurgents, and its own complexly varied tribal cultures for the past decade, sadly, it's not often that we hear about positive stories coming from Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean they're not there.
One such story is that of Skatistan, the NGO project that has put skateboarding into the heart of Kabul and encourages young people to express themselves through the sport. The project works with youths aged 5 to 18 and has been in the Afghan capital since 2007. The success of the program inspired British photographer Jessica Fulford Dobson to head to Afghanistan to photograph the young boarders. And the images have been celebrated in 2014's Taylor Wessing Photographic Portrait Prize. And those images are now on show at London's Saatchi Gallery until the 28th of April. And Jessica joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. This is a beautiful set of pictures, but this must be balm to a photographer's vanity, surely. This is an amazing... This must be the moment when you first saw these skateboarders, you must have thought, this is a photographer's dream.
Well, yes. I mean, I think when I read this little article, that it was tiny, I almost missed it. And I don't really read many newspapers because of all the doom and gloom we read. But it was a sort of one of those supplements, and I was flicking through and I thought, hang on a minute, skateboarding, Afghanistan, girls. And I was brought up with a cousin who, it was a boy, and he skateboarded. And I thought, oh, hang, you know, so I was sort of used myself to thinking that's what boys do, not girls. And then I thought, well, isn't this amazing to read about this that's happening in Afghanistan, a conservative country, but yet, and a place where actually often you don't hear that girls can actually even do any sport. And as soon as I read it, I thought, gosh, I want to see this. And I thought, and I'm sure, you know, I could see an exhibition and I thought, I'm sure that it's not just me who'd want to see this because we're all fed up with, yes, bleak news that we hear from that part of the world. And I thought this was so refreshing and uplifting to hear something that we all need in this day and age at the moment. We need to hear some good news. We need to see the sunshine in places just to sort of keep us all a bit sane, I think.
We need some people doing a half pipe.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
So that impelled me to sort of then, and I feel very proud of the fact that because often with photographers you can be handed projects and so can you go off and do this, and it's very difficult in a world where really sex, celebrity, and violence is what grabs most people's attention, and to now have a collection of photographs where celebrities are going to enjoy them and look at them, and it just involves little girls and skateboards. I feel very chuffed with, and the reception since the launch at the Saatchi Gallery, or actually even since the award, but it's particularly sort of gone all around the world now since the launch. And, you know, there are people coming in from as far-flung as Australia. We got Norway, just across the globe, coming in, just saying, we love these photographs. And I even got a quote from someone in New York saying, we're obsessed, you know, when are you going to bring them over here? And it's amazing for a photographer in this day and age to have something that's suddenly capturing everyone's attention. And it's very simple pictures, really.
Well, we'll talk maybe a bit more about some of the subjects of the pictures in a moment. I wanted to ask you, though, about the sort of the backdrop. You've already alluded to it with the sort of conservatism that people will know about in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Clearly, it must have been something of a surprise to see this club and these girls participating there. Were you ever worried that even taking that additional step of documenting it might make people rather uncomfortable? It's one thing for this to perhaps be sort of tolerated by parts of society, but for then that message to go, as you say, very international. Did you sense unease? Were you worried that it might be a difficult journey?
Well, I think when I first approached Skatistan and their European offices, which are in Berlin, what I loved is the fact that they were very protective. It wasn't easy by any means, and I liked that even more because they were very protective of the school. They didn't want too many foreigners going in there. And I think also a number of other sort of journalists had gone in, but not really sort of helped in as much as, you know, the school needs funds in order to keep going. And so when I felt that I was in good hands and that I was with people that knew how to handle things properly, and the fact that if they were prepared to take my idea, and because I was going at it from a more artistic angle, really, rather than as a journalist, because I'm not a war journalist. I don't go to war zones per se, and I don't normally. But it was one of those things that when I saw it in my mind, and I've learnt that when I can see that I've got to follow that to the end and as much as I can. And so when they then said, look, okay, yes, we'll give you permission, you can come out. When it was suddenly the reality of going to get the visa and realising that I wasn't quite going to sort of a holiday destination, one might think, for other, I realised, you know, not everyone is necessarily heading there, particularly as going as a lone entity and as a woman. But I sense that I myself have taken for granted very much my freedoms living over here, and I was very bored of feminists and things growing up. I thought, what bore? You know, I do what I want anyway. And it was so naive, though. And it was 4 years ago when I went to see some photographs at the Hayward Gallery, where there were portraits of young Afghan women who'd had acid thrown in their faces from their husbands or members of the family just for looking in a certain way or doing something. And I remember, for the first time, feeling these emotions in me, thinking, this is outrageous. You know, why are, you know, to be controlled in such a way? So anyway, all these things made me realise that actually this was something quite important. And the fact that I was going after it and then they opened the doors, I just felt, well, I must go there because I think it's more important, particularly as we were all leaving Afghanistan, certainly from the end of last year, you realise that any good work that has been done there must not be forgotten about. And it's wonderful that at a time now where people are either fed up or want to move on from Afghanistan, that you've now got the Skate Girls of Kabul representing girls from all parts of the world, that actually we mustn't forget about the help they need. And their story sort of can symbolise a lot of girls everywhere.
Skateboarding is always, I mean, it started off at least as a countercultural thing. I mean, it's sort of about freedom. And possibly in this case about emancipation, certainly, because they're girls and they're young. And how much, I mean, this kind of comes out. These girls are cute young girls, yeah. But some of them have got quite, they're staring down the camera with quite a kind of steely gaze, aren't they?
They
and
are.
Some of them just look pretty and are kind of very,
and
kind
adorable.
Of like seem
yeah.
quite,
yes.
quite sort of free and,
yeah.
you know, fancy free. What was the taking of these pictures like? Did they need a bit of arranging? Did you want to capture them just as you'd found them? We're always interested in not the veracity of the pictures taken necessarily, but you know how willing the participants were.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Well, I think they're very, very interesting, and I realise actually I mostly didn't fully answer your first question as I started zigzagging around, is, you know, how to handle all of this, because
yeah.
obviously they go out to all the parents to ensure that they're happy, and the parents ensure that the way the school is run fits with them and their culture, hence why going in at a grassroots level, it's won the trust of the people. And also, again, when the skateboard arrived, it wasn't seen as a boy or girl thing. It was just like this board. And, you know, there was the odd father that would say no. And then a week later, he'd turn up because the child had screamed the place answer. And he said, just take her, you know, let her enrol in the school.
Well, it's an interesting thing. If that hobby doesn't exist in a country, then suddenly girls pick it up before boys. It becomes a girls thing rather than a boys thing. It doesn't have this whole thing, the loaded nature that maybe it has in the US, the UK.
Yeah, and I think that's actually what I found really refreshing about it. And getting to photograph the girls, I love the fact that some of them are in their party dresses
yeah.
to skateboard. They dress up for it because it's a big day.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in other parts of the world, it's predominantly boys doing it, and it's all a bit more sort of, you know, by no means they're dressing up in black tie or their sort of fancy suits to skateboard in.
Now, there's an idea. Decline and Fall meets skateboarding.
And so it was very, but the when I went in, because I was photographing also the other side, which was just, it is a great story, but also behind it, it is, as some people described, art with impact. So we're going to see beautiful portraits, but actually a reminder that beside all of this is the fact that the girls are getting an education. And they do that before they actually skateboard. So my first introduction to them was in the classroom, and they were all said, you know, Jessica's going to be here for a few weeks, and this is what she's doing. And if anyone's unhappy and they don't want to be photographed, just, you know, raise your hand or get up. And there were very few. I remember this second year it was different because I had a new class, and I remember a number of girls got up and walked out. And it was, again, quite interesting. I thought, in a world where I come from, where youngsters long to all be being photographed, it was quite refreshing to be in an environment where some of them weren't, they weren't all desperate necessarily to be recorded. However, once they understood me or saw how I worked and watched some of the other girls who were happy for it, the others became sort of less shy and actually ended up wanting to show off their skateboarding technique or just to stand proudly with their board. And I mean, I myself, I don't like being photographed, but it's just very interesting to see how that would go. And I was very keen from start to finish, as with Skatistan, that, you know, if the children went back and the parents asked them, what did you do today? That it was very much that they understood that their child had the choice of what they were doing and whether they were to be photographed. And that was always been, I had to always be aware of that. And even getting the pictures over here, even though the permission had been got, re-permission was got in order for them to be in a book and in a gallery. Because again, that they're proud to the fact that they can sort of help promote something that is doing a lot of good and is working with a culture rather than changing it in any way. And I think that in itself is a lesson everywhere.
You mentioned this notion of, you know, art with impact, and I'm sure every artist, every photographer wants their work to be impactful, whether it's just on aesthetic terms or because it has a wider symbolism. You'd already said at the start, oh, you know, I'm not a war journalist. I don't go to these sorts of arenas. Did the experience of working on this project and seeing, I guess, the kind of the bigger picture, forgive the terrible pun, of what it can mean and what it can achieve, do you think that's will shape your work going forwards from now? Will pictures with impact or art with impact mean something a bit different for you now that this project has sort of had such a success?
Yes, no, thank you. That's a very good question. I think for many years, I mean, I've been a photographer now for 13, 14 years, and I remember in the early days, particularly as a portrait photographer, the first thing people ask you is, you're a portrait photographer, you know, who famous have you done? And it's that awful thing of thinking, well, you know, I had done the odd person, but nothing of any particular note, in my opinion. But I remember feeling the frustration of, you know, trying to find your path within the world of photography, where you can either be a fashion photographer, a paparazzi journalist. And I was always trying to sort of negotiate my way through, and I'd work with other photographers who'd been very commercial, and it was quite hard when you are coming at it from a more artistic angle. I know, you know, some people argue art, photography, all these different things, but I would say my inherent nature is from a more artistic bent, rather than, because I don't look at something and think, oh, what's the commercial value in that? I just go at it with more of a passion, and without sounding too warm and fuzzy, with a heart. And so for a long time I have been looking and searching for thinking, you know, how can I, in a world where everyone is taking photographs, everyone is doing something, that can actually mean something? And I think, so I had been looking for a while, and I think in answer to your question now, certainly, I always felt that when I read that small article, look, I could bring this story back to life here, and I think people would be interested to see it. But I had no idea that now I've got a story that is touching people all over the world, and I'm even getting, you know, retired photojournalists saying it's amazing to see some amazing photographs in a world where everyone takes photographs, but, you know, there is a dearth of people that can actually get the sort of photographs and expressions that you're getting. And that's, you know, it's amazing to have that. And again, to have it through a very charming, innocent story, really, which just at the end of the day is all about joy and happiness. And we all know if you go around a lot of art galleries or certainly photo shows, there's a lot of grim and provocative photography, where it's trying to shock people. And I think, again, it's nice to have something that actually we all long for, something quite cheerful.
Light and shade, and these pictures are certainly joyous images. That's Jessica Fulford Dobson, and the exhibition is on at London Saatchi Gallery until the 28th of April, and they're captured too in a very beautiful book, unless I'm very much mistaken.
Yes, no, that's right.
Jessica, thanks very much for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly.
Time for some music now. We're about to hear about the joy of jumping in the Thames, so let's enjoy a bit of the similarly spontaneous and random Loudon Wainwright with The Swimming Song.
That was Loudon Wainwright with The Swimming Song, and we'll be talking about swimming and other things in the River Thames next on the Monocle Weekly.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive, and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Caitlin Davies is an English author, journalist and educator whose latest non-fiction book is Downstream, a history and celebration of swimming the River Thames. Born in the UK, she spent many years in Botswana, where she wrote for the country's first tabloid newspaper, The Voice, and then became editor of the Okavango newspaper too, and that setting has inspired fictional works such as Jamestown Blues and The Return of El Negro.
Now back in the UK, Davies seems constantly inspired by her immediate surroundings, and her latest focus is that dark, churning, powerful artery through London, the River Thames, and more precisely, why people choose to jump into it. She's found time to join us on the Monocle Weekly. Caitlin, welcome to the programme. Great to have you with us. I guess there is part of, when you look at, you know, great cities and great rivers, and, well, a river that goes way beyond the limits just of a city, in fact, to really understand it and what it means to people, it's not really enough to walk next to it or walk over it. You kind of need to get right in it.
You need to swim in it, I think, to understand London and understand the Thames, and, you know, and the fact that swimmers have used it since the beginning. You know, people have always, okay, they were just bathing in it or having a dip, or, you know, the Romans were training to be soldiers or whatever. But as we get into more modern times, and particularly in Victorian times, you know, swimming became an art and a science that everybody could learn to do. And here's this massively long 215-mile river. What a great place to swim.
Yeah, it's one of those things we should address this at the beginning of our chat, I think. When does bathing become swimming? Because, you know, there's lots of people that live near water that can't swim in it or don't, or choose not to swim in it. I wonder when, you know, the simple necessity of washing oneself, washing one's clothes, became a bit more sporty. I mean, we always think in Britain that we kind of codified all these sports. But I wonder when, you know, when it became something to do with leisure rather than something just to do with necessity.
I think it became organised sport. Again, you know, the Victorians, bless them. I would say sort of like 1840s is about the earliest sort of competitive race I've come across in the Thames, where, you know, it was organised and they were doing it for a wager. Probably someone that was quite well off had bet that three, you know, not well off men could, you know, I'll bet this and we'll see which one could win. Mm. And then you had around the 1860s, you had a lot of manuals came out, you know, directed at gentlemen, to show them, you know, the different strokes and illustrations of what to wear and the best time to swim and, the, you know, what to eat before you, and, you know, underdone meat and home-brewed ale was the best thing to do before you had to swim.
Oh, God, was it, you could be writing about preparing for the Monocle Weekly itself. Pardon me.
So I think it's about then that, you know, it starts to become a sport. And then you have Captain Matthew Webb being the first British man to swim unaided across the Channel. I think that year, 1875, was really important because, you know, he was the hero of the hour, the hero of the empire, and now children all over the country want to emulate him. And at the same time, you've got the building of indoor baths, so people are going there not just to wash, but to splash around, and now they're having lessons. And then you have self-styled swimming professors who were teaching people how to swim, men only to begin with, but then they were teaching women as well.
It's interesting you talk about Matthew Webb there, and that's a name probably, you know, a lot of people were familiar with because, you know, his achievement was legendary, and he's been sort of celebrated and documented down the years. As you researched and wrote the book, did you find there were lots of other stories, maybe not of comparable notoriety, but that were equally compelling? Was it quite a pleasure to sort of uncover these other extraordinary
biographies? It was completely brilliant. It was the most fun I've had for a long time. This was the best non-fiction book I've ever read, partly because no one threatened to sue me, which was nice.
That always helps.
Because, you know, swimmers are on the whole a nice group of people, and people that swim in the Thames love it, and they want people to celebrate it, and they want other people to know about it. So Captain Webb, I'd heard about him, although recently I had been asking people, have you, you know, even people of my age, 50 plus, you know, you must have heard of Captain Webb, and they haven't. So maybe he's not as well known as I thought he was, but there were people just as well known as him at the time, and Agnes Beck with his my favourite example, because in 1875, just a few weeks after he'd swum the Channel, she jumped off a boat at London Bridge and swam 5 miles to Greenwich. And she was just 14 years old at the time, and she was wearing cumbersome Victorian, you know, swimming outfits. And she was, like, hugely successful. She toured the United States, and she was champion lady swimmer of the world. And I've seen a show bill where, in fact, she's above the bill with Captain Webb. So Agnes comes first and then Matthew Webb comes second. So at the time she was, you know, and her impact on the world of swimming, I mean, here's a young woman not wearing that many clothes in public, competing in a male arena and pulverizing records. And until recently she's been, you know, nobody knows about her. She's never been inducted into a Hall of Fame. You know, she hasn't got the accolades that Matthew Webb has.
Your book is obviously it's really interesting. It's a history of the river, and it's also a history of it's a social history of the people that hopped in and enjoyed it. But there's a poetry to it inevitably as well, because there is something kind of grand, prehistoric, elemental about the River Thames, as in all big rivers, I suppose. How interested are you in that part of it, and the idea that swimming in a river is something very different to even swimming in the sea, let alone a nasty chlorinated swimming pool? I mean, what is there something to do with the current, the movement that is very enticing for you?
Well, I only discovered that really when I went back to the Thames to swim in order to do the book. Mm. So I had a dip in the Thames, a splash as a child when I was 10. And then for 40 years, it had never occurred to me, even though I'm a Londoner born and bred, although I've lived abroad for a long time. And so to do this book, the publishers, the editor said, I suppose you'll have to do a few swims. And I thought, yeah, right, I'll just interview other people that have swum in the Thames. And then I thought, well, yeah, maybe I better sign up to do something. And by then I was really worried about it. You know, could I do it? Would I get ill? You know, everything we've sort of been indoctrinated to fear the river. And the big thing, I swum from Buscot Lock to Radcot Bridge in Oxfordshire.
Yeah.
And what struck me from the minute you get into the water is that there's no beginnings and endings in a river. You know, when you're in a pool, obviously you're going from one end or, you know, to the other. Same, you know, in a lido, the same in a pond as well. You're going from one edge, one bank, you know. Whereas when you're in a river, you are following the river. So, you know, you don't know what's going to come next when you come around the corner. So the landscape is changing, and there's no point where it's like, okay, I've finished now. And also with a river, you've got to think about where do you get in and where do you get out. And that, I mean, I found it very sort of spacey. You know, there was one point where I'm not a fast swimmer and I'm not competitive, I'm not a sporty person. There's a big gap between me and the people in front. And, you know, for a while there, you're just sort of floating. And there's nothing, you know, there's no sound. You're simply in the river. So, yeah, I mean, I can't wait to go back and do it again.
Can I ask you about that? I mean, is it a nice experience then? I don't know. People talk about...
Have I made it sound nice?
Well, no, you have.
That sounds kind of dreamy. And yes. You imagine being borne along by the current,
yes,
and it's quite sort of... There's a sort of romance to it. But
there
I wonder,
is, yeah.
People often say, oh, but it must be very dirty. And isn't there loads of pollution? And what about things that are lying on the surface? Or there's all, you know, stuff that gets carried around and rubbish and stuff like this. Is that just not what it's like?
Well,
and if that's not what it's like, why do you think people are obsessed with that side rather than looking at all the positive things about
it? Well, I think, I mean, there's a lot of parts to your question there, you know, and there are dangers on top of the river, you know, and in the river and underneath you. But I think that, you know, people of a certain age, we might have swum outdoors, you know, as children, and then we would have been, you know, prevented, stopped, banned, warned against swimming somewhere like the Thames, with good reason, you know, in terms of pollution. And so you therefore suspect, especially if you live in London and you see this sort of grey, rippling water in the middle of the city. I mean, I look at it and I think, how did anybody swim in here? So when you get to the Upper Thames, the water is very clear, it's very silky. What struck me is there was no smell. I think I expected it to smell of something. And then also, it varies so much. So at one point this was with a swim with a company called Swim Trek that organised Thames swims. And I was swimming along thinking I'm getting a bit tired, and the guy in front of me suddenly stood up and the water only came to his knees. And I thought, oh my God, I'm swimming in water and there's hardly any water here. You know, so everything that happens in the Thames is just sort of surprising. And then I swam in the Millwall Dock in East London, and that's a completely different... I mean, there, you know, the water's a different colour, it has a different smell. And then, of course, you get down to the estuary and it feels like swimming in the sea.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? There are so many different sensations to be got, so many different qualities of the water, depth of the water, so much different flora, fauna, industry, lack of it, countryside around
exactly.
that river. Up around sort of, you talk about Cookham and Henley and Hurley and up around that area as well. I mean, that's when it's a very clean, fast river. There's lots of boats on it, but it's very clean and fast. You know, in the city, it is slow. Because, of course, it used to be, it's become narrower, hasn't it? As developments happened, because, of course, it used to freeze. Famously, there was winter fairs and there was skating on the river in the middle of London. Presumably, it was narrowed. And that's made it flow faster so that it doesn't freeze anymore.
When you had the new sewage system in London and then you also, around 1875, it was finished and you had the embankment. So if you think of Somerset House in London, that was right on the banks of the Thames. I mean, the King's boat would come out and be on the water. And now you've got to cross a busy main road. That's how much of the Thames we lost, as it were. So the embankments made the river narrower and made it faster flowing. And when you're talking about it being fast flowing sort of outside London, around Lechlade, where it's, you know, near the official source, I mean, for 5 miles, I didn't feel any current. I wasn't aware of being whisked along at all. It was only one point when I turned around and swam back, as it were, that I realised that I was now swimming against something. And when you're in London, and I got the Port of London Authority to take me out on a patrol boat to show me why they've introduced that you're not allowed to swim in the Thames in central London anymore. And I mean, looking at the water bashing against the bottom stones of London Bridge, you do think, yeah, if a swimmer was in there, you know, they would be in trouble. Mind you, equally, you know, you get to Southend and of course you've got the whole tide and you're at the North Sea.
Yeah, which is an equal, well, at least sort of elemental, scary qualities, right? Presumably as well.
Yeah, but then also magical, because when I went there, I swam with the Chalkwell Red Caps, which are the fastest...
The what? Fastest,
Chalkwell Red Caps.
What a great name for a team. I want to be...
Do you?
Yeah, they're selling shirts.
They are. Okay. It can be arranged. And they they just started, like a lot of clubs along the Thames, as wouldn't it be fun to swim in the estuary? And they've gone from, you know, a couple of people to, I think they have something like 250 members now, ranging in age from 7 to 82. And what for a lot of their swims, they swim around the Crowstone, and the Crowstone is this massive obelisk in the water, or not, depending on the tide, that marks the official end of the Thames. So for me, I started at this sort of tombstone-looking monument at the source and ended, you know, clutching myself and trying to put my arms around this obelisk, you know, while the waves are sort of buffeting me from left and right.
Caitlin, I just wonder, you mentioned that you can't swim in London anymore. Do you think a city loses something if people can't connect with the river? It was like the lifeblood. There was this very primal relationship with it. If that's taken away, is that a shame? Or do you think that, sadly, you know, the health and safety sort of people, best to that?
It's a difficult one because, I mean... you know, health and safety has some good aspects. If it's health and safety, for example, for people at work who are doing, you know, risky jobs, you need to be protected. But when you look at the Thames, you think, As an example, you know, in 1936, the King opened the Tower of London Children's Beach. And the reason for that was because, you know, children from the East End of London had been swimming on the little beaches around the Thames, and some had got into trouble and some had drowned. So instead of banning it, which would be our impulse today, the response was, OK, they're doing this, let's make it safer.
Have more children. No, I said have more children.
Oh, have more children. let's make it safer, and you know, bring in some more sand and make the beach and open it for certain hours, and have people on patrol, you know, and on duty in case something's going to go wrong. So your question is like, well, what's going to happen now with the Thames Bath project, which the crowdfunding started first thing this morning, and I think they're already doing really well. If that goes ahead, will we have a floating bath again in the Thames? Because people definitely want to use it, and that would be a way for us to be in the Thames in a safe way, because jumping into the Thames in central London is not a safe thing to do.
Do not try this at home, kids. It's fascinating stuff. It is called Downstream, and the author is Caitlin Davies. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink programme, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Former chief reporter for The Independent, Steve Boggan, has been turning his reporter's eye to more unusual stories in recent years, such as his 2012 book, Follow the Money, for which he followed a $10 note around the USA for 30 days, seeing where and with whom the small percentage of the nation's wealth might end up.
Steve's been back in the US recently and looking at material even closer to the nation's heart than money. Gold. The gold rush in the 19th century was part of the allure that led much of the nation to be settled by Europeans, and the shiny stuff's attraction is just as powerful to some today. So Steve decided to head out there to learn just what it means to be a panhandling prospector in today's United States of America. The result is his new book, Gold Fever, One Man's Adventures on the Trail of the Gold Rush. And Steve joins us now to tell us more about it. Steve, welcome to The Weekly.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you with us. I don't know, it's hard to escape the idea of, you know, the gold rush, the quest for wealth. And I wonder, in some small way, you know, is that what appeals? It has this unique luster, gold. Even the story about it has that sheen to it. Is that one of the things that drew you on this sort of journey?
It is. I mean, first time round, people genuinely thought they were going to be able to pick up gold off the floor and become instantly rich overnight. And an awful lot of people did in the very early days. These days, it's a little bit more like a lottery. You know, most of the easy gold has been picked up. So people go, most of them, they know that they're probably not going to strike it rich, but it's a bit like buying a ticket for the lottery. You know, you're probably not going to win, but you buy a ticket anyway.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because there's obviously the idea of hope is so much bound up in the gold rush, in your book about it. And you know, your book is populated by people that are not crazy, but you wonder always if they might, you know, if there are other things about their life that are as unusual as their kind of desire to go and make their fortune. Is that the word that links everybody together in the book, this idea of hope?
It is hope. And the thing about it is that even when you meet people who quite clearly haven't got what we might think of as gold fever, you know, they say that their habit's under control. They just do it in their spare time. They do it for fun, which a lot of people do. You know that the whole time they honestly believe that one day they might, you know, hit that pay streak. I mean, just last year, a guy with a metal detector found a 6-pound nugget that sold at auction for $400,000. And the problem with things like that is that that's what gives everybody else that hope. And the thing about gold and the way that I went looking for it, because of course you can dig underground, which is what the mining companies do. What I did and what most people do is they prospect in or near rivers in the good old fashioned way with a pan, you know, and you can do that. You can actually go panning just with a, you know, a trowel and a gold pan, and you can find gold. But each year that gold is washed down from a, there's a 120 mile long subterranean load. A load is a vein of metal bearing ore. And this stretches for 120 miles. It's called the Mother Lode. And it runs the whole length of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And because it's trapped below ground in quartz, as there's erosion from above, some of it gets exposed. And then each winter and each spring with the floods, some of it's washed down. And it sort of, it goes down to the rivers. So each year it's replenished a little bit. And that gives fresh hope every year.
Well, I guess what also gives hope is that exactly describe that load. I mean, what's in there? How much of it has been discovered? Because people are going to presumably continue to have this hope and have these dreams, however maybe, you know, unrealistic they are. While all that potential wealth is there, people say it's what, 80, 90% of it is still in there. Well, it's still in the ground.
Yeah, these estimates, they say that, that there's about 80% still in the ground. And if you bear in mind that in 1849, somewhere in the region of 300,000 to 350,000 people went looking for it, they found the what's called placer gold. It's on the surface. That's the name for it. Apparently, it's originally harks back to the word for pleasure. When you found it on the ground, it gave you great pleasure. And they sort of adulterated the name, called it placer gold. That's the stuff that was picked up originally, about 350,000 people. But of course, most of those people, the best that they could do, the most industrial they could get was a sort of the little drift mines like the ones you saw in the treasure of the Sierra Madre. But even the big mining companies still haven't found very much. If you think about the fact that it's 120 miles long, yeah. Now, the Empire Mine is the most successful underground mine in the history of California. It extracted gold, I think, to the tune of about $8 billion. Now, that was open for 106 years. It was a huge corporation. It employed tens of thousands of men over the years, an awful lot of them from Cornwall, by the way. And so for 105 years, these people, these men dug. They dug 300 miles of tunnels, some to a depth of 11,000 feet. And all of the gold that they extracted during that 105 years would fit into a cube measuring 7 feet by 7 feet by 7 feet. And that was the most successful mine.
It's a sobering thought, isn't it? And it's enough to, presumably that is the ultimate antibiotic to treat gold fever, right?
It is reality,
I suppose.
Well, it is, except for the fact that it also makes you think, well, if those guys only got a 7 foot cube, there's a whole 120 miles left for me.
I suppose so, it works both ways. And that's the thing, I wanted to ask you about this idea of gold fever without spoiling, we want to, you know, obviously push people in direction of the book without spoiling it. I wonder, you know, whether you could see gold fever as an abstract concept, or whether you were like a sort of a J.G. Ballard hero and you went to document these strange people and ended up the worst one of all.
Well, I didn't, because one thing I can say is that not once but twice I gave gold away.
He's coming, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, dressed like B.A. Baracus.
Well, twice I gave gold away. So I don't think I had gold fever. Yeah. But it's an odd thing, because the definition of gold fever is a mania for seeking gold. And there I was, I'd given up my regular work, I said goodbye to my sort of long-suffering fiance, and I'd taken a flight to San Francisco pretty much on a whim, all the while convincing myself that that was perfectly normal behaviour. And of course, in retrospect, it wasn't. When I got there, I thought that because gold was involved, people would be, it'd be a bit like, what is it, Gollum, you know? People wouldn't help you find it. They wouldn't tell you how to find it or where to find it. It was the opposite. I was absolutely staggered at how much help people were prepared to give me. Other people, when I said this, said, well, sure, but they're not showing you the real place they got gold.
Yeah.
Who knows? Well, you know, you never know. But it was just fascinating. Some of the people I saw who were trying to make a living out of it, they definitely had gold fever. I mean, you know, some of them had sort of traded everything for, you know, they'd try and get better equipment because they thought it would get them more gold. And sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. But the ones who were trying to make a living out of it, you know, their only overheads would be a tent. You need a vehicle up in the mountains. But, you know, they'd have a tent and a vehicle. And they were making enough money to live on. And, you know, they were sort of hunting for food sometimes, sometimes just going down to the shops and buying it. They were drinking water from the spring. They didn't have anybody telling them what to do, and they were finding gold. And some of these people were amongst the happiest I've ever met in my life.
Did you find that on this journey specifically? We talked about it in the introduction, you know, go west, young man, all this kind of thing. Did it help you to understand more about modern America? Do you think that this quest for gold, that, you know, the pursuit of newness, the journey west, is that still that frontier spirit almost? Does it help you to place modern America in a different context?
The people I met, there are two types of people, those that do this for fun, and there are a lot of them, and they're the ones who will tell you that you know, their gold fever is under control. But later on, when you get to know them better, they'll tell you about the vault where they've hidden all their gold, and then they'll show you some of their gold, and you realise that actually they can't bear to cash it in. They can't bear to let go of it. So a lot of those people surprised me because they were retired. When I first saw old people digging for gold, I thought this was really sad until I got talking to them, and then it completely turned things on their head, because these people were doing this. Their retirement, for the most part, was settled, was solved. They were secure. So they were sort of doing it for fun, but they equally were the people who couldn't bear to part with their gold. So there's that type of person. The other type who were trying to do it for a living, increasingly I felt that they were sort of trying to get off the grid. You know, they were trying to disappear. Finding gold gave them the ability to just go under the radar, completely disappear. I mean, I met one guy who was ex-military, and he had cancer. And he'd beaten cancer when I met him, but he'd suffered very, very badly, lost a lot of his intestines, a lot of his stomach, but he survived. When it was all over, he found out that he wasn't entitled to benefits. And so he was feeling very angry with the world, and he took off, and he did that thing that, you know, we imagine Vietnam vets doing sometimes, who want to disappear and they go off into the woods. You know, he really did do that. And he just survived by bow hunting and, you know, living on his wits. But amongst the very few possessions he had were two large inner tubes from a truck. And he said he used to put his rucksack on one and his few possessions on one of these things. On the other one would be him, with a cocktail shaker and a bottle of vodka. And he launched both inner tubes into a river. And wherever he ran aground, that's where he'd dig for gold. That was in the early days. He now had, he'd gathered possessions when I met him. He had a caravan, he had a car, and he was probably the happiest person I've ever met. He was completely free. You know, there's that old country and western song, isn't there? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. He was free. Really, really free.
Well, so that's the thing. Maybe we can end on the idea of you address it in the book, but I wonder whether you can reach a conclusion now. You've stepped back from writing it and having that the actual journey physically as well. Whether gold is more interesting for its symbolism than for its practicality, actually, for people.
I think in the practical sense, it is. If you're on the ground and you accept that you probably won't get rich, I'm not saying I didn't get rich. You know, obviously this is. This interview is being conducted, you know, from my ship to shore radio in the Caribbean.
Exactly.
But what I found more than anything was I was quite impressed with the number of people who came to the conclusion that their health was much more important than any goal they found. I found an awful lot of people who were recovering from terrible illnesses, from depression. I found one guy who'd been paralyzed from the waist down. He'd actually asked his wife to put a bullet in him. She refused, obviously, and shortly afterwards he discovered panning for gold out in the mountains and in the country. And he sits there paralysed.
There is faith wrapped up in all of this.
Absolutely, and all of these people realise that your health and your family and all of these sorts of things, ultimately, more important than gold.
Well, it's a fantastic story, brilliantly told. Steve Boggan, thank you so much for coming in. The book is called Gold Fever, One Man's Adventures on the Trail of the Gold Rush. I don't think we spoilt any plots in that, but nice of you to join us.
Thank you very much.
On the line from your gin palace.
Thanks,
Steve Boggan, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And there we have it, Tom. That was edition 303 of the Monocle Weekly.
I liked edition 303.
Well, we had a really good guest, didn't we?
That was a cracking lineup.
I think at least two out of the three of them enjoyed being here. Two.
I think it's probably the 100%.
Yeah? You reckon three out of three?
Three out of three. And it makes me want to go and prospect for gold, I have to be honest. Steve. It's quite inspiring, talking about that, you know, the freedom, just you out there on the mountains, camping out, you've got your little tools there. You know, and your pan.
I think there was a lot of, all three of the, our subject matters today were sort of in some subtle way linked to freedom, weren't they? People kind of trying to break out of the constraints that they find themselves in, jumping in a river, prospective gold up in the Rockies, or the Sierra Nevada, and indeed like skateboarding in a kind of very male-dominated.
That was great.
Strange
and those pictures,
society.
They're so charming. They're such sweet pictures as well. A really positive message. I like that. Freedom theme.
Freedom theme. It's the Freedom 303. 303 for freedom.
303. Great.
Let's stop while we're still ahead, or I'll make another one of those terrible jokes that I made to Caitlin Davies that I don't know if it ended up in the edited version, but let's leave it there. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back again, same time, same place, next week, probably with the same team on board. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.